If they went to kill the kid, Evan would have to move to stop them, which seemed unlikely to result in his staying alive. If he got cut down here and buried beneath the sod beside this unappealing teenager, he wondered if anyone would miss him. He thought about Mia's mouth at his ear, her hands pressing his wrists to the mattress above his head. For the first time in a long time, there would be something for him to lose. Garcia's voice came dry, little more than a squeak.
No.
No? Aragon asked. What do you mean, no? The answer is yes, is it not? The boy nodded, wiping at his cheeks. In the darkness, a coyote bayed, seemingly on cue. And then the silence asserted itself once more, black and heavy. Aragon leaned back, crossed his arms. What do you think we should do with him, Kiki? Kiki hooked his thumbs through his straining belt loops on either side of the oversized buckle. Teach him a lesson, patron. Break both arms. Shoot out a kneecap. He knew the rules. Eduardo? Aragon said. Special Ed considered for a moment. You have to put him in the ground, patron. Your reputation. Word will spread. These are uncertain times. You can't have people stealing from you and living to talk about it. Garcia gave a sob. The PMCs looked uneasy. Aragon nodded somberly once, twice, then reached into his pocket. Garcia's knees buckled, but he kept his feet. Aragon pulled out a fat bankroll and peeled off a dozen hundreds. He held them out to the boy. For your mama's pills, he said. If your family needs something, you come to me. Never lie to me again. Understand? Tears streamed down Garcia's face as he took the bills and stuffed them into his front pocket.
Thank you, patron. Never, patron.
A held breath burned the insides of Evan's ribs. He let it ease out through clenched teeth. Change never comes in the perfect future, Aragon said. It comes in the messy here and now. He patted the boy's cheek, lighter than a slap, but just barely. I believe in you. I believe you know how to change. Garcia nodded again.
God bless you.
He stepped backward, tripped over his heels, went down, and got back up, moving away the whole time.
God bless you, patron.
Aragon said to the PMCs, see that he gets home safely. The three PMCs departed. The skin of Aragon's face looked battered, his eyes 1,000 years old. He put his hand on the ledge of Evan's shoulder. Come with me, he said, lumbering for the house. He got a few steps and then paused, spit in the grass, looked back at Kiki and Special Ed. Don't give a boy's advice to a man, he said. Chapter 17. Recalibration. Aragon moved wordlessly, soft footing through the dormant house. He led Evan upstairs and into the study. Fabric couch, bookshelves, a built-in desk with nothing on it. Not a true working space. Above the couch, a wood-handled rifleman's dagger was framed in lucite for no apparent reason. A rose-gold-and-white marble bar cart in the corner hosted a variety of high-end liquor bottles that seemed at odds with the rest of the middle-class decor. Aragon noted Evan's gaze and said, "Gifts." "Of course." "I could use an amigo de borrachera," Aragon said, "now more than ever." "Do you drink?" "I've been known to have a sip now and then. Should we indulge?" Evan leaned against the desk. "I could use a finger." "I have some fine mezcal with worm salt from Oaxaca. I prefer vodka." "Vodka," Aragon said dismissively. "I know, I know. It has the most impurities removed. They say that makes it cleaner. But I think it makes it boring. Give me impurities any day. Pete, Smoke wood? A surprisingly warm smile. But you're the guest. He lifted a black bottle with bold red lettering. Have you heard Blavod? It's a German vodka, black, like our hearts. He poured a bit of the ebony liquid into two crystal old-fashioned glasses, handed one to Evan, and they clinked. It derives its color from ketachu, Aragorn said, a heartwood extract from Burmese acacia trees. But that's probably more information than you care to know. You'd be surprised. The vodka washed down Evan's throat, coated the inside of his stomach, seating him in his body. He exhaled in full for the first time in nearly 48 hours, and Aragorn matched him, sinking down onto the couch. Evan said, "Bit of spice in the aftertaste." The biggest trick alcohol ever pulled was making us believe we like the way it tastes. Aragorn held the glass aloft, peered through the inky wash. What if we called it what it was? Medicine. Panacea. Tinctures to turn the dial of our moods this way or that. Evan stared down into his drink, thought of what little he knew of his mother and half-brother. The current of alcoholism that ran through his genes like a live wire. Discipline and force of habit kept his affection for liquor in check, but he felt the draw of it in his cells now and again, to loosen, to unclench, to give up and give in. From the way Aragorn eyed the cart, he knew that his host heard the siren call as well at times like these. "What's with the framed dagger?" Evan asked. Aragorn unbuttoned his shirt and slipped it off one shoulder, a thin white scar carved 6 inches to the left of his sternum, just beneath the collarbone, where someone had gone for the axillary artery. "Back in the day," Aragorn said, "when I was still, how would you say it, more hands-on, a transaction that went wrong. It didn't go deep." He smiled. Not on me, at least. So you framed it? Like your first dollar bill? No. To commemorate the price of my stupidity. And his. A scattering of gray hair covered Aragorn's chest, the musculature surprisingly pronounced for his age. I came home, and Belicia about took my head off. Angelina. At the mention of his daughter's name, a shadow moved across his face. She was a newborn, so my wife demanded changes. And you obeyed. Obeyed? That is not a word we use in our marriage. I listened. He tasted his vodka. My home has always been my refuge, even when Belicia and I fought. Even when we threw plates and screamed, that's been true. My wife has kept me safe from my own worst self. But never by trying to neuter me. Not like the games your suburbanites play. Mommy wives and their little boy husbands. No, I didn't obey. I waited until I understood why she is almost always right. Almost always? I have to hold out hope. Leaning over, Aragorn gave himself another healthy pour, swung the bottle in Evan's direction, but Evan declined. It sounds like a cliché, that my wife is the wisest person I know. But my friend? And here Aragorn leaned forward and grew intense, even threatening. You haven't met my wife. Amusement reshaped his face, that unorthodox handsomeness showing through. Leaning back on the cushions, he took a gulp, let the liquid swirl in his mouth. Evan felt it too, a touch of heat about his temples. The measure of a man is how tough he can be to the world, and how sensitive he can be to women. Aragorn took another sip. Women are fucking Swiss Army knives. Throw anything at them and they figure out which part of them to use to fix it, care for it, make it better. They can hear if a baby's cough is just a cough, can smell if something's burning in the next room. They can see when our arrogance is serving us and point out when it's not. His tone was angry, but Evan sensed what was beneath it, a current of remorse, self-disgust, grief. Aragorn was looking at Evan, but his eyes were glazed, distant. I have a wife who used to dance in the kitchen while she cooked dinner. When I was in my right mind, I'd sit and just marvel at her. And before you get modern on me, she could do the same thing while running a corporation or performing open-heart surgery. She could do anything. Women don't have to compete with men. Men aren't fit to kneel at their altar. He stared into his glass. But I wore her down. I wore her down with my childish needs. No. She wore herself down trying to make me less stupid. And I dressed up my cowardice by calling it manliness. Evan thought of his conversation with Mia, the post-coital flush still high on her cheeks, her body warm against his. The coming dinner at her brother's house, the day-to-day realities that ground men down, but also, maybe, that could build them up. Aragorn stared at him, his eyes brimming. He blinked hard a few times, heavy eyelids holding everything back. A few years ago, I could have gone fully legal. I could have had marijuana grow houses as big as Costco's, teams of lawyers making sure every T was crossed. I have enough money already. Nobody would get hurt. But it's force of habit, yes? Chasing the thrill, feeling like a big shot. He sneered. El Patron. The last of the black liquid drained into his mouth. My choices. And my choices alone put Angelina at risk, along with everything else. Genuine curiosity stirred in Evan's chest. Aragorn's flaws were prodigious, perhaps fatally so. But he knew things Evan did not. For an instant, he felt how much he missed Jack, the first person who'd treated him with care. There'd been a comfort in knowing that there was someone ahead of him on the climb, who'd seen a broader vista. Aragorn reached with a groan to offer the bottle again, and Evan told himself it would be rude to refuse. The sloppy pour splashed a few drops onto his knuckles. I considered myself a wise man, Aragorn said, but I didn't understand humility. Why, it's adjacent to wisdom. Maybe even the same thing. How so? Aragorn lifted his glass, the black vodka threatening to slosh over the top. My daughter's kidnapping has forced me to confront the full measure of my blindness. And maybe now, finally, I will find the courage not to turn away. If I confront myself for the fool I am without drowning in shame, then maybe I will be granted the wisdom to make things right. And there it was, the slightest tug at Evan's insides, a recalibration of the man sitting before him. Was it possible that he actually liked this man, an accomplished drug dealer and innovator of illicit markets? What did that mean about Evan's hard and fast rules, the carved-in-stone commandments? There was a softness in Aragorn's face, a vulnerability behind the eyes. Aragorn shifted on the couch, elbows on his knees, glass dangling in both hands. I feel like a hermit crab. You ever have one of those growing up? Those were for rich kids. Aragorn smirked, but there was no meanness in it. As they grow, they have to shed their shells to search for new ones, bigger ones, that will accommodate who they might become. I feel like I've outgrown my old shell, but I can't find a new one. It's like I'm at the bottom of the ocean scuttling across the sand, predators swirling overhead. He drank again. Talk, talk, talk. Listen to me. None of this is helping us find my daughter. He screwed a fist into one eye and yawned. I need to sleep. I will give you everything I know about the Leones tomorrow. He offered his hand. Evan shook it. Aragon's grip was firm, but not too firm. The confident grip of a man with nothing to prove. Evan said, "You have until I find her and bring her back." "Have until then to do what?" "Figure out how to leave all this behind. The drugs, the trafficking, the money laundering." Aragorn's cheeks bunched high around that bulbous nose, his face raw and rough like something carved from mahogany. "Or what? Or I'll come for you." "Ah," Aragorn said, "only you get to decide who lives, who dies. Only you know what is right. Only you have the unassailable moral compass." "No, not just me. But I can choose what I do. And for whom. And you don't find me worthy?" "No," Evan said. "But your daughter is." Aragorn grinned, though his teeth were clenched. "Quite a position you put me in," he said, "given my love for her." "Your love for her," Evan said. "Maybe that's what will save you. From you." "No." Aragorn blinked at him a few times. Some kind of understanding passed between them, but it was too complicated to put into words. Evan set down his glass half full. "I should get going." "Nonsense. Nonsense." Aragorn moved to the closet and racked open the flimsy slatted bifold doors. He removed a set of sheets and a pillow, tossed them on the desk. "Come. Help me pull out the sofa bed." "No, thank you. I won't stay here." Aragorn slid the cushions off the couch and strained to tug out the folding bed. "The motel in town is shitty. Trust me, I own it. You stay here. Grab a few hours of sleep. We have much to review, and can't waste time with you driving off and breaking back in to hold a knife to my throat." Aragorn threw one side of a fitted sheet across the bed to Evan. "Come on, come on." He gestured once more, his manner impatient and disarming, and Evan found himself dumbly listening, pulling the elastic corners into place. Aragorn laid down the top sheet and blanket while Evan chinned the pillow into a case. He had never made a bed with someone else. The act was oddly intimate. "Bathroom's up the hall on the left," Aragorn said. "Fresh towels on the rod, toothbrush in the drawer. Do you need a mint on your pillow? A burned fentanyl tablet?" "The black vodka and dagger of Damocles should suffice." Aragorn came around the end of the bed, crowded in the small room, and rested his powerful hands on Evan's shoulders. "Thank you. I'm glad we didn't kill each other." He embraced Evan, wrapping him in a bear hug that Evan was too stunned to return. Then he was gone. Evan stood a moment, pillow in hand, replaying the bizarre domestic episode in his head to determine if it had actually happened. It seemed it had. By the time he'd stripped off his shirt, kicked off his boots, and moved out into the hall, the master door was closed. He walked quietly to the bathroom, where he found a toothbrush in a drawer as promised. He brushed his teeth and then washed his face with French milled soap shaped like a snail. Feeling insufficiently settled to shower, he pulled off his shirt and rinsed off in the sink, then dried himself with a fluffy lavender towel. When he emerged, slinging his shirt over his shoulder, one of the doors in the hall was slightly ajar. Felicia's. There was no more than a few inches of black at the door jamb. Had she cracked the door to listen to him? Or had air from a vent in her room suctioned it open? He set his bare feet down silently on the carpet, heel to toe easing toward Belicia's room. He stopped just outside. The black interior gave up nothing. He was at a disadvantage backlit here in the hall, a welcome target for bullets, or carbon fiber arrows, or a tomahawk throwing axe if someone got creative. And yet curiosity pinned him to the spot. The air leaking through the gap smelled of air conditioner Freon and something else. Something vaguely medicinal. He strained to listen, his face inches away. He sensed the air tremble, and then the door pushed shut abruptly, the brusque snap of wood in the frame startling him. He stood a moment bare-chested, drops of sink water cool across his chest, embarrassed to realize that his breathing had quickened from the scare. Moving back to the makeshift guest room, he sat cross-legged on the bed, debating whether he had it in him to meditate. He didn't feel like it in the least, which was usually a sign that he needed to. But every time he tried to focus, his thoughts pulled out of shape. To being a guest in someone's home, and the unfamiliar mix of vulnerability and obligation that elicited in him. To Aragon's mysterious wife who'd soft slammed the door in his face. To Latia also slumbering right up the hall. To Angelina, wherever she was sleeping. Or lying awake in terror. His mind raced, the alcohol converting to sugar in his bloodstream, his mind jumping across the mission, picking at details, yawing wide and zooming in. The photos from the party, laughter and lipstick, the saccharine cinnamon scent of Angelina's room, that caravan of dark SUVs conveying her away like a stolen princess. He couldn't catch the rhythm of his respiration, couldn't reduce himself to his breath. The sheets were not his sheets, and the bed was slightly uneven, the taste of the air unfamiliar. He'd been in plenty of unknown places, but being part of an unknown place, not just a trespasser moving through, felt intensely uncomfortable. He pictured the books downstairs ordered by height except for that one, sticking up out of place, an affront to its neighbors. He gave up on meditating. Turned off the light, and drew the covers over him. Still, that fucking book disrupted his thoughts. 5 minutes passed, then 10. Above his head, the entombed dagger stared down at him, and he stared back. Finally, he slipped from bed, tiptoed down the stairs, crept into the living room, and confronted the offending hardcover on the bookcase. He took it off the shelf, slid it along the line of ascending spines until he found its proper spot, and then seated it in place. He exhaled. Without knowing it, he'd broken a sweat, but staring at the books restored something in him to order. He headed back upstairs. All the doors were closed, including Belicia's. He returned to the study, closed and locked the door behind him, and climbed back into bed. At last ready for sleep, he shut his eyes, laying one hand on his chest and one on his stomach, letting his breath rise through his palms. He was just drifting off when he felt a vibration in his pocket. The room zone. Caller ID showed Joey. He clicked to pick up, but before he could say anything, her voice came in a rush, strangled and tight and devoid of its usual sardonic edge. "I found her," she said. "Jesus, X. She's already dead." Chapter 18. Other Unfavorable Lowlifes. The thin gray air of early morning found Special Ed and Kiki parked surreptitiously in an alley between two ratty houses on the American side of the Far Reynosa International Bridge. Special Ed drove an 8-wheel pimp white Eldorado with custom body panels to cover the stretched chassis, so surreptitious was relative. Aside from his longtime pal Kiki, the car was his favorite thing in the world. The bridge was for commercial crossing only, an endless stream of box trucks and semis arcing from the Mexican state of Tamaulipas above wetlands on the 4-lane bridge, bringing in oil, natural gas, fruits, vegetables, and countless kilos of drugs. The shortest crossing time of any port in the state made it popular for smugglers. A Leones Teniente nicknamed Chango ran a stash house where the goods were cached before being dispersed to various cities in the southwest and on the west coast. His bailiwick was product storage, oversight, distribution, and logistics, banal front work that removed him from the orbit of sicarios, halcones, and other unfavorable lowlifes who might draw the attention of local and federal law enforcement. Part bookkeeper, part CFO, Chango was a key point of access, running one of several hubs for the Leones operation. The stash house was unguarded, unalarmed, no cameras to memorialize the business conducted within. Anyone sufficiently streetwise to understand what went on behind that vinyl-sided exterior would never dare to rob it. Eduardo and Kiki sat in the maroon velvet seats, cowboy hats pulled low on their brows, pistols resting lengthwise on their knees, sunglasses turning their eyes insect-like, predatory. They had a thin manila folder, a schedule of Chango's comings and goings, a bowie knife sporting the decal of the Gulf Cartel, and two shotguns in the back seat in case an escalation was in order. So, Eduardo took another beat to mentally process what Kiki had just divulged to him. "You're gay." Kiki frowned, his bushy mustache shifting. "Si, amigo." "And you never told me." "Don't see why you'd care." "Huh." Special Ed cast a glance across at his friend. Unshaven around the messy mustache, bulge of flesh pushing over his belt buckle, shirt buttons barely holding on. The polyester fabric, a yellow that had faded to off-white, hadn't been ironed for at least a few outings, the wrinkles sprouting sub-wrinkles at the elbows. "I thought you were supposed to be like two people in one, a guy and a girl. Have nice clothes and shit." Kiki shrugged. "Yeah, I didn't get that part." "And I thought you was supposed to worship Lady Gaga and have a flat belly like them oiled-up maricones in the music videos." Kiki looked down at his belly. "What do I know? I grew up in this dumpy-ass body." "You fuck anyone I know?" Kiki shook his head, his double chin rasping against his overly starched collar. "No." He tapped a sausage finger against his thigh opposite the 44. "Wait. That one guy from the job in Tempe. The cabana boy-looking motherfucker we shot in the swimming pool? No, no. The manager at the hotel." "That guy? That guy wasn't gay." "Could have fooled me when I had his..." "Okay, okay." Special Ed contemplated the revelation, squinting into the rising sun. Then he grabbed Kiki by the scruff of his neck and jogged him a few times roughly in his seat, grinning widely. "Fuck, Kiki! Look at you! Getting some ass at the Red Roof Inn!" It was a Red Roof Plus. "And let's not get excited and make this a big deal." "It is a big deal! It's you! Have you told your mama?" "Are you fucking crazy?" "I bet she knows," Special Ed said. "On TV, the moms always say they knew all along." "She doesn't know. And can we just..." He stopped and pointed. "Look, there's that monkey-faced motherfucker." They watched Chango pull into the driveway in a businessman gray Hyundai Elantra. The garage door shuttered up unevenly. The Eldorado jogged on its shocks as Special Ed and Kiki got out, Eduardo tapping the fuzzy die for good luck. He tucked the folder into the waistband of his jeans at the small of his back. The Elantra eased into the garage. They strolled across the street, ducking beneath the creaking door as it closed. Chango had already entered the house, so they paused in the dank garage to get their bearings. Shrink-wrapped pallets lined the far wall, bound bundles advertising coffee and carrots and pineapples. They took a moment to admire the quality of the packaging. Eduardo used the tip of the enormous bowie knife to flick through the side of a pineapple, releasing a trickle of white powder. "Piñas," he said approvingly. "We should try that shit." The door to the house was unlocked. Most of the floor was covered with stacks of products on pallets. Cardboard boxes and cartons and plastic tubs. The short hall led to a living room equally crammed, a narrow path carved through the rise of product. The foyer remained relatively clear, no doubt to allow the flow and egress of the packaged goods. But the kitchen where they found Chungo looked like a hoarder's paradise, boxes climbing the walls all the way to the soffits. Chungo stood over the sink, his back turned, shoulders jiggling as if he were washing a dish. Eduardo and Kiki eased quietly through the doorway. An MP7 rested on the round wooden table to their side. They raised their pistols, Special Ed keeping the blade low by his thigh. Kiki cleared his throat. "Excuse me, friend." Chungo turned around, circular ears stuck straight out, echoing his round face. They were the feature that had no doubt earned him the nickname, though the others competed. A thatch of dark, stiff hair formed an improbably low hairline, the result of bad transplant work. Bad genetics, or both. He was spectacularly ugly. Small, beady eyes took note of them, then moved to the submachine gun out of reach at the kitchen table. "Hello, my friends," he said with an unctuous grin. "I was just making guacamole." He tilted the yellow bowl in his hands to prove his point. "We've been branching into avocados. Legal and expensive. Green gold, we call it." "I understand," Kiki said. "We have debated doing the same." "Perhaps I can serve you some," Chango said. "My grandmother's recipe." He started for a cupboard. "Let me grab us some chips." "Allow me to get them for you," Kiki said, sidling forward and opening the cupboard door. A Beretta rested on the shelf above a bag of blue corn tortilla chips. He plucked the bag out, handed it to Chango. Chango nodded. "Thank you, my friend." While his hands were occupied, Kiki patted him down. "I trust you understand who this house belongs to." The neck of Chungo's t-shirt stretched wide, showing off a ball-chain necklace and sweat glistening at his collarbone. "Indeed we do," Kiki said. "That's good. I wouldn't want you to underestimate the amount of danger you are in." "We have not, though your concern is appreciated." "The house is wired with surveillance cameras," Chungo said. "Right now, this very conversation is being live-streamed to my bosses." "We know that is not the case," Kiki said. "The risk of recording who and what moves through here is too great. Perhaps you have this confused with another stash house." "Perhaps so." Chungo considered them both. "I have a delivery due any minute. A big crew coming in to unload it. Roughnecks from Ziraquaretiro. The avocado belt, you see. They are quite difficult to control. I fear that they might interrupt our discussion." "I'm afraid you might be confused," Kiki said. "The Ziraquaretiro delivery isn't due until 3 o'clock, which gives us plenty of time." The bowl and bag of chips sagged in Chango's hands. "Perhaps we can sit at the table," Kiki suggested. "That would be good." Chango walked across the kitchen, and they sat. What little light might have made it through the closed Venetian blinds was blocked by a rise of tomato crates. The overhead bulb flickered a Morse code of hideous yellow. "Let me clear this," Kiki said, sweeping the MP7 off the table. "For the guacamole." Very thoughtful. Chongo set down the bowl and the chips. Well, Special Ed said, aren't you going to open the chips? We are your guests. Chongo popped the bag and slid it around to face the other men. Eduardo scooped a healthy heap onto a chip and thrust it into his mouth. Hey, this shit is good. Your grandmother knew what she was doing. Cilantro and... Wait, don't tell me. A tiny bit of mango to take the edge off the jalapeno. Chongo sat stiffly, his face expressionless. A bead of sweat worked its way from that dense hairline, curving down in front of one of his unfortunate ears. I assume you want to take something. Product, cash. I have plenty of both. Perhaps we can save some time if you tell me what you require. Eduardo guided another heaping chip into his mouth. I'm thinking I can't believe my buddy here. A chin jerked to Kiki. Just came out of the closet. Chongo's head pivoted to Kiki. Really?
Yeah,
Eduardo said.
Times are changing.
I mean, the Sinaloa are even using sicarias. They're hot bitches, too. Have Instagram profiles, posing in G-strings with tigers and gold-plated machine guns.
So I'm thinking,
he chewed some more, that in this day and age, my best friend here won't have to suffer any discrimination. Chongo cast a sympathetic gaze at Kiki.
I never would have guessed.
Funny that, Special Ed said. Looks like your gaydar's as shitty as mine. But yours should be better. He reached behind him, and Chongo flinched. But Eduardo came up with the folder, which he tossed onto the table. An 8x10 photograph slid out, showing Chongo in a compromising position with a young man. The young man was without pants, but he was wearing a backward baseball cap with a logo matching the one carved into the handle of the Bowie knife, CDG, inked in the green, red, and white of the Mexican flag.
See, that's how it came up between Kiki and me, Eduardo said. We were reviewing these pictures, and I made a... What did you call it?
Kiki said, derogatory remark.
That's right. So he came clean with me, to make sure I was more respectful about him being a maricón.
So I guess we have you to thank for clearing that shit up for us in our friendship. It's true, Kiki said. We are grateful. The sweat running down Chongo's face had quickened, his T-shirt spotting. He chinned at the photo. I assume you know who that is. Eduardo picked up the picture, regarded it with a squint, then turned it sidewise and squinted some more.
Looks like you. I mean the man I'm with.
The son of the president of the Austin affiliate of the Cartel del Golfo. Just turned 20. Promising future. I'm sure El Moreno wouldn't want you putting your dick in the enemy. I'm sure he'd know that a rival would need to protect his family name by eliminating a pedo. He is a legal adult, even if that meant going to war. So to answer your question, no. We don't want product or money. We will touch nothing in this house. Except you. Chongo lifted the collar of his T-shirt to wipe off his forehead.
You still can't kill one of us. When a leon bleeds, we all bleed.
Eduardo took the photograph and used the knife tip to carve out the face of the young man in the picture so that it couldn't be used against him after they left the photo behind.
Then I suppose El Moreno will have to take that up with the Gulf Cartel. May I?
Chongo's voice went dry, soundless. He tried again.
May I ask who you represent?
Aragon Urrea. You might be familiar with him. He has a daughter who is the center of his universe. Chongo went to wipe his face once more with his shirt, but then grabbed through the fabric and stuffed something into his mouth. Eduardo's hand shot out, clamped around his throat, and squeezed.
Chango's chest heaved a few times in silent despair until Eduardo released his grip and Chango coughed something into the guacamole. Eduardo dug it out. A USB zip drive. The broken ball chain necklace swayed beneath it, coated with guac. Chango hacked some more, a squiggly vein bisecting his forehead. He caught his breath. You'll never crack it. You'll never... Eduardo swiped the knife across Chango's throat. His beady eyes flared and his legs pumped under the table high enough that his kneecaps tattooed the wood. Then he fell forward, hands spread on either side of his face, as if he were taking a nap. A crimson slick expanded beneath Chongo's head. Eduardo plucked up the photograph before it was sullied. Holding the picture up against the wall, he drove the knife through the center, pinning it in place. The hilt proudly displayed the Cartel del Golfo logo. Special Ed used a handkerchief to wipe off his prints. Eduardo tossed the zip drive to Kiki, who slid it into his pocket. Together, they headed out of the kitchen. Chapter 19. Terrible Things. Evan reached the morgue an hour after sunrise, deep into Leona's territory toward the last grimy outskirts of Guaridon, where the wind-blasted buildings grew more sporadic, civilization yielding to scrubland. He'd crossed the border at Brownsville in the trusty Buick Enclave, using a passport in the name of Ryan Miller. Then he forged 3 hours northwest into Nuevo León, heading for the location Joey had named for him. The view was monotonous, deadening. Dirt and greasewood bushes and cacti, everything a smear of brownish yellow. The imprimatur of La Familia León proliferated, the blue-eyed lion spray-painted on rusting traffic signs and rendered on the sides of abandoned sheds, watching everyone and everything. Evan smelled the morgue before he saw it, the air through the vents tinged with something vile. A converted restaurant set back from the road, cracked adobe with orange and pink paint that the sun had vanquished to a pale memory. He pulled in to park, coaxing a pellet spray of sparrows from a desiccated ebony tree at the lot's edge. He opened the door, and it hit him in the face, the inside-out smell of rupture and rot and a terrible sweetness. He crouched for a second outside the car, hoping the air close to the ground would be clearer. It wasn't. He drew himself up and entered. The door gave a cheery chime, a remnant of restaurant days. Candles everywhere. Veladores of Mary, San Toribio Romo, and the Virgin of Guadalupe breathing vanilla and apple cinnamon. Copal incense burned in abalone shells. A sacerdotal ambiance, sure, to respect the deceased, but its primary failed function was to disguise the undisguisable scent of decaying flesh. The air conditioning kept the place cold, but not cold enough. A woman with a long, bookish face sat behind a counter so crowded with files that she was visible only between the stacks. She looked intimidatingly intelligent. She did not glance up as he drew close, but continued scribbling away on a form. He waited patiently. The corridor behind her was crammed with stretchers, one pinning back the swinging doors to what used to be the kitchen. A massive freezer unit beyond had a thick glass door, showing a large interior crowded with bodies to the point of bursting. A few zipped black bags waited outside the door. He sensed movement out of sight. A closer glance showed the files surrounding the woman to be post-mortem packets. Several had spilled over, exposing death certificates, field reports, digital photos of ruinous faces, sloughs of skin, and shiny white teeth protruding from baked adobe gums. Others showed the bodies where they'd fallen, mired in desert sands like fossilized specimens from an extinct past, their mouths filled with dirt where the winds had buried them alive. One picture showed a gruesome Pietà, a dead mother with a desiccated baby at her breast, mouth fastened in a vain attempt to nurse. They'd been mummified in their own flesh, their skin turned to cracked leather, like a horror movie effect. Close-ups captured tattoos, dental work, shoes, underwear, wallets, jewelry. Evan stared down at a glossy depiction of a coroner's latex-covered hands violating a woman's mouth, spreading blackened lips to show off a gold-rimmed incisor. Evan lowered his voice with respect. Perdóneme. She started, jerking back in her chair, then looked up at him with black-rimmed eyes and a 100-yard war zone gaze. He said, Estoy tratando de identificar el cuerpo de una joven que usted tiene aquí. Identify a body? She said in crisp English. Are you Migra? PD? Sensing that she was not someone who could be lied to, he shook his head. Family member? I'm here on behalf of a family member. I'm sorry. There are legal issues. Confidentiality. She jotted a few more items on a form. You like to think we don't care about such technicalities here, but we do. He remained quiet. 30 seconds passed. Another 30. Finally, she dropped her pen in frustration and looked back up. What? You go to extraordinary lengths to try to identify these bodies for the family members, he said, posting photos of tattoos and personal effects on the database. I represent a father who is wrecked with grief and concern over his daughter. Will you please allow me to confirm if he needs to start making arrangements? She stared at him. He wondered if she ever smiled. He wondered if it was even possible after doing this job. Why do you think she's here? In the personal effects you documented was a locket necklace, he said, given to her by her father. He held up the picture on his phone. She took it in briskly, then typed at her computer for a moment, the monitor's glow illuminating her reading glasses. Abruptly, she scooted her chair away from the counter and walked back to the kitchen. It took a moment for him to realize he was to follow her. The air conditioning blasted in the kitchen, but was no match for the bodies on gurneys shoved against the walls. Two of her co-workers moved among the dead, taking photographs, jotting notes on clipboards. A few corpses were laid out on the stainless steel counters and rolling work tables that had once been used to chop lettuce and whisk cornmeal. A faint hospital hum of machinery, tubes feeding the bodies, preserving the flesh. Is it always this crowded? Evan asked. This is the overflow morgue. That's why we are here on Sunday. 7 days a week. She gestured at a Negro Modelo sign hanging in the sole window, its neon tubes coated with dust. As you can see, we make do with what we have. Today is worse than usual. They found an ice cream truck abandoned in Chihuahua. 15 bodies locked inside. They smell. It hits you like a paste. She snapped on latex gloves and walked around, checking toe tags. Evan followed, breathing through his nose, fighting to hold his gag reflex at bay. Behind them, a camera flashed and clicked. The pinche guías don't care about anything, she said. They take their money and pump them full of coca or diet pills to power them through the desert. Some have heart attacks. Some are left behind, alone beneath the sun. And even if they do make it, the cartel gets their filthy hands on their children back home, makes them work off an endless ransom. It's slave labor. The people working all around you, in your hotels and fields, mowing your lawns. She halted before a parched form on the prep counter, lipless and noseless, skin shrunken around the skull, features demolished by triple-digit desert heat. A clipboard rested beside the corpse, showing basic identifying information and the coordinates where her body had been discovered. Here. This is your Juana Doe. It was difficult to believe that the shriveled form before him was once a vibrant human. More difficult yet to think that it had been Angelina. A plastic bag tied to her ankle held the locket and chain, 3 rusted hair clips, and a tube of melted lipstick oozing maroon. The woman loosened the bag on the ankle, removed the locket, and handed it to Evan. He clicked it open. A posed wedding picture, Young Aragon beaming in a tuxedo, Belicia in flowing white, their hands clasped before them in a way couples never held hands in real life. He thought about Angelina's room, posters and fluffy throw pillows, the tears on Aragon's cheeks as he recalled them at the beach when she was a baby. Evan's thoughts bled into Joey's wanting to go on a road trip, out alone in the world where things like this happened to young women, where one minute they were smiling at their birthday party, and the next laid out on a stainless steel prep table in a makeshift morgue. The fourth commandment, never make it personal. He cleared his throat, cleared his mind. How am I supposed to confirm her identity? Wait, the woman said, picking up the stick dry arm and examining the hand carefully. She might be ready. From a nearby drawer, she removed an ink pad and a blank note card. She inked the corpse's prints and tried rolling them onto the pad to no avail. The fingers are not plumped up enough yet, she said, and even when they are, the prints might be ruined. Sometimes you can slide the skin off the hand, Evan said, and wear it like a glove to press the prints more fully. She stared at him, her long face growing even longer. Who are you? I've seen terrible things, too. He gestured at the body. She nodded. He reached for the hand and tugged gently at the skin, but there was no give. It had been baked onto the flesh. He leaned on the table, regarding the body. Knobby knees turned inward, ribs visible, collarbones pronounced. And there, an unnatural curve beneath the leathered flesh of the breasts, a kind of roundness not found in nature. Evan looked at the woman, gestured at the breast. May I? She nodded once more. He pushed the skin at the side, felt the hard silicon edge beneath. His heart quickened, a surge of hope. From what little he knew of Angelina, he thought it unlikely that she had gotten breast implants. Can I? Do you have a scalpel? The woman must have read the emotion in his face, because she got a scalpel and returned to his side. I will do it, she said. She carved a 6-inch incision down from the armpit and applied gentle pressure until the translucent yellow implant popped out. She ran it under the faucet to clear the body fluids, and then placed it beneath a desk lamp clamped to the sink. The serial number, rendered in soft relief. Before touching his phone, Evan washed his hands and then washed them again, keeping the water hot enough to turn his flesh red. A quick Google search brought up a legal website for breast implants, showing which models were eligible for recalls and which were considered safe. He typed in the number, realized he was biting his lip, stopped biting it. The surgery had taken place at Centro Medico Internacional on Sexta Sur y Avenida Longoria. 11 years ago. Angelina would have been 7. He exhaled, lowered his head. What? The woman asked. It's not her. She rested a hand on his shoulder blade. He appreciated the gesture, but didn't like being touched with hands that had just touched the dead. I'm happy for you. Thank you. This will help us, too. We can find her family, and perhaps get her a proper burial. He looked her in the face, taking in those black-rimmed eyes. You do important work, he said. Yes, she said. I do. He left her there among the bodies. The air outside provided little relief. Pausing by his car, he thumbed off a text to Joey. Not her. He drove with the windows down and the air conditioner high. The smell was in his hair, his clothes, his pores. He passed a motel and pulled over, paid cash for a room. The clerk wrinkled his nose as he handed over the key. Evan grabbed his duffel bag from the trunk, went inside and stripped naked, piling his clothes in the corner. He took a shower, scrubbing himself from head to toe, and then dressed in an identical set of clothes. By the time he emerged from the bathroom, The stench of death had emanated from his clothes and hung heavy in the room. He found a metal trash can in the alley behind the motel, dumped in his clothes, and burned them. But he couldn't get the smell off his hands. Back inside, stripped down again, another shower. He dried off with a fresh towel, flossed his teeth, clipped his fingernails, stole a bedsheet to sit on for the ride back until he could air out the seats. He wanted to have Guaridon in the rearview before the afternoon came. That's when cartel violence intensified, peaking by design just before the 6 o'clock evening news. Menace and marketing, hand in hand. He rode the whole way with the windows down. It was dusk by the time he arrived back at Aragon's complex. Special Ed and Kiki were waiting at the front gate, bullshitting with a few PMCs. Eduardo was cradling the arm Evan had nearly hyperextended, but released it quickly when he recognized the car. Evan slowed, stuck an elbow out the window.
"You don't just leave whenever you want," Eduardo said.
"That's exactly what I do."
"Keep talking back," Eduardo said, "and you'll see what happens."
"How's your arm?" Evan said. Kiki smirked a little, and Eduardo glared over at him. Evan held up Angelina's locket, let it dangle beneath his fist. "Open the gate," he said. They opened the gate and hopped into a jeep to follow. As Evan coasted up to the house, the front door opened and Aragon came out onto the porch. Twisting one hand in the other, he walked toward Evan, meeting him at the driveway. "I came from the morgue," Evan said. "It wasn't her. But I found this." Aragon took the locket, and his knees buckled. Evan steeled him with an arm across the small of his back.
"I'm fine," Aragon said irritably, pulling away. "I'm fine."
He stared at the locket, then clenched it tight and pressed his fist to his forehead, shutting his eyes, his lips moving in a silent prayer. The jeep remained at the curb, Kiki and Special Ed keeping a respectful distance. After a time, Aragon lifted his head and looked at Evan. Violent men and trauma victims often recede behind their faces, shrinking back and in, leaving flat eyes to face the world. Aragon's eyes weren't like that. They held a staggering depth of knowledge and pain, and life lived unflinchingly and close to the marrow. Soulful eyes, the eyes of survivors who do more than survive, of war veterans and the terminally ill and the grateful living, the eyes of those who refuse to give up or look away or retreat into numbness. His voice came hoarse and cracked.
"And now?"
"The Leones," Evan said. "What do you have on them?" Aragon's jaw shifted left and then right, as if resetting itself.
"I know them better than they know themselves."
Evan said, "Tell me everything." Chapter 20. Filthy and Subhuman. Angelina was tired of lying in bed. Her head throbbed, and she felt nauseated and hot beneath the slow-turning paddle fan on the high ceiling. She cast off the covers, and then a freeze hit her, so she pulled them on again. She sobbed quietly for a time, curled inward, one hand pressed to her stomach, the other held over her face as if she could close her eyes to the desperation of her situation. Her pillow was wet with tears, her sheets damp with sweat, and she was exhausted from trying not to make noise. She was hungry and sticky and completely unmoored. Her father had always said to take the world on in your own terms, to hold true to what you felt was right and force reality to organize itself around you, good or bad. That's what she'd have to do now. Even now. She slipped out of bed, anticipating the cool floor. But even the tile had been warmed by the satanic heat. Cracking the door, she peered out into the hall. It looked clear. She started to step out when a low ticking noise came from the hinge side of the door. She yelped and spun around. Darling boy sat on a chair, back to the wall, eyes glimmering at her. A guard post. He was scolding her, making a clucking noise with his tongue against his meth-rotted teeth. The inked band around his neck rippled with the movement of his Adam's apple. She drew another sharp intake of breath.
Why are you here?
El Moreno wants you watched. All the time. He made a horrible grin by stretching his loose lips outward, seemingly pleased by the opportunities that watching her might afford.
Where's Raimundo?
You don't get to choose who watches. She realized she'd drawn back behind the door, hiding her body, peering around the edge at him.
I'm hungry. I need to eat.
Food will be brought. Even at this distance, his breath smelled like death.
I need a towel.
He rose, his bald pate shiny from the light.
I will fetch it for you.
As she withdrew into the room, he shoved the door from the outside, scooting her in quicker. A metallic click announced itself. The deadbolt was reversed, the latch on the outside. She ran her palm across the smooth wood. The first time they had locked her in the room. She moved backward on wobbly legs and sat on the bed. After a time, she heard darling boy's footsteps tick-tocking across the tile, drawing closer. Revulsion churned in her stomach, climbed the back of her throat. The door unlocked. He entered, holding a towel in his hand. A chemical smell wafted off him. Meds and body chemistry gone bad. She took the towel. It was soft and fluffy and felt brand new. She stared at him. He stared back. In a foreign country, on a guarded cartel estate, behind a door, alone, with darling boy. It took a moment for her to find her voice.
Will you excuse me?
As I said, another gruesome smile.
You are to be watched.
She entered the bathroom, shut the door behind her. No lock. It was vulnerable making to undress, but she felt filthy and subhuman. Layers of panic sweat dried on her skin, her hair greasy and tangled. She started the water, stared at herself in the mirror. A thin line of broken capillaries where the necklace had been torn from her neck. It had caught on the seatbelt when she'd been hustled out of the SUV for the sole bathroom stop they'd allowed. She no longer had the photograph of her mother and father the locket had held. She no longer had anything of who she had been. The steam began to mist the mirror, and she stepped into the shower, easing the sliding glass door shut. She lathered herself up, using soap for her hair, feeling the blunt edge where Montesco had taken a lock of it, scrubbing beneath the stream. And then she sensed it, the faintest squeak of the hinges. Panicked, she swiped suds and water from her eyes. Through the fogged shower glass, she could see darling boy filling the doorway, a dark cutout from the light beyond. She didn't breathe, didn't move. He didn't either. Fixing her stare on him, she rinsed off as quickly as she could. Her breath kept hitching in her throat, and she made an effort to draw full inhalations so she wouldn't pass out. She turned off the water. Still, he didn't move. The fog was lifting from the glass. In another minute, he'd be fully visible to her, and her to him. She eased the door open, the towel rack just beyond reach. No way to get there without exposing a breast. She leaned out, snatched the towel, jerked back into the false safety of the shower stall. The mist carried the scent of him. It seemed to fill the room. She wrapped herself up. He stayed in the doorway, staring, unblinking. The last bits of fog evanesced from the glass. She was trembling from the cold. She hadn't dried her hair. He wasn't smiling that awful smile. He just stared at her, his eyes focused with longing and something beneath it, something hard-edged and aggressive. He looked underfed. He took a step forward. She reached out and grabbed the handle to hold the shower door shut.
Hey!
A voice from behind, from the bedroom. Raimundo stepped into view.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
Darling boy hesitated.
Your father told me to watch her. Not like that.
Do you understand me? Not like that.
Raimundo was breathing hard, and Angelina sensed fear in him. He was heir to the throne, yes, but darling boy was a sicario. He had done things that a young man like Raimundo and an 18-year-old girl like her could scarcely imagine. She used the distraction to slip past them both into her room. She grabbed her clothes and stood in the corner, facing the wall, holding her towel in place as she slid on her panties and jeans, her bra and t-shirt. Behind her, the men murmured, their voices low and angry. Finally, she turned around, toweling her hair.
I have to go, Raimundo told her. He understands now. He doesn't understand anything, she said.
Darling boy watched them mutely. She knew she was risking his wrath by taking a stand, but if she didn't, she would be here alone with him.
I want to go with you.
Raimundo said,
Where I am going isn't safe for you.
I don't care. It's safer than me staying here.
My father will be there.
You don't want to see what he is going to do.
She looked at darling boy.
Those eyes, that skin, that hungry look. I don't care. I don't want to stay here. I don't care what I'll see.
Raimundo bobbed his head sadly.
I will find you a jacket.
He paused at the door, looked down at the floor.
You might regret what you ask for.
Chapter 21 Lack of Professionalism.
Aragon led Evan, Kiki, and Special Ed through the living room with its array of floral scents, down a brief hall devoid of decorations and art, to a room in the back of the house. Even here, at the heart of the guarded compound, three deadbolts secured the door. Using a key hung around his neck, Aragon coaxed them back into their housing and knuckled the metal door open. It swung inward to divulge a wide room nearly filled with an enormous Faraday tent. Nothing rimmed the perimeter aside from cables and power sources snaking across spotless white carpet. It was an impressive setup. Double wall construction, metal mounting frame, good ventilation. No electromagnetic or radio frequencies would be leaking in or out, protecting the system from intrusion. A soft whir issued from the RF noise source generators parked just outside the zip doors. In single file, the men whispered through the slick fabric, entering the inner sanctum. A giant computing powerhouse. Six stations with screens and hardware. Tempest-certified computers. Gigafoil V3 filters on the Ethernet lines. EMI EMP signal and data filters for the power sources. The nerve center of Aragon's operation.
I'd like to bring in my associate, Evan said, to pool our resources. She knows more about tech than anyone I've met.
The person who hacked our system yesterday? Special Ed interjected.
Evan ignored him, keeping his attention on Aragon. Can you open up a secure messaging channel to her? Special Ed and Kiki bristled at the suggestion, but Aragon held up his hand, quelling their protests.
Is this person to be trusted?
I've trusted her with my life.
You are asking me to share intel, Aragon said.
We need to figure out how to infiltrate the Leones, and we need to do it better than the last guy you sent.
Aragon's mouth pulsed as he chewed the inside of his cheek. I expect you to maintain impeccable control over your underling.
Evan gave a hesitant nod. Stepping out of the Faraday tent, he called Joey. She answered in a telemarketer's cheery voice.
Covert former government assassins are us.
Joey, knock it off.
I'm going to open a channel for you into Aragon's operation, okay? I need you to play this serious. Understand?
Okay. Jeez. Call 911. Your sense of humor's gone missing.
Oh, wait, I forgot. You don't have a sense of humor. Put appropriate audio modulation and visual filters on, Evan said. Vocal disguise, facial recognition cloaking, and make sure everything runs through virtual private network tunnels. I want 24 software telephone switches.
It's so adorable when you mansplain to me about encryption. Any hair advice?
I'm thinking of doing frosted blonde tips, and that also seems to be right in your bailiwick.
Joey, this is different. I'm plugging you straight into a connection with a cybersecurity mastermind.
Once I'm done shuddering with anxiety, I'll be on my best behavior.
Josephine!
What? I'll play it straight, okay? Texting a link now. God, X!
She hung up. His rum zone chimed. He re-entered the tent and keyed in the link on one of Aragon's computers. A window popped up. Blackness. And then the connection came through. Evan saw Joey's avatar and heard the sound of his molars grinding. She had disguised herself using a manga filter that gave her giant neotenic eyes, fluffy alien antennae, a cute bunny nose, and a wagging dog tongue.
"Greetings, boomers," she said, the tongue shedding cartoon saliva droplets. "What are you doing? Listening to Neil Diamond? Comparing social security statements? Reading blogs on gut health?"
Evan felt three sets of eyes swivel to rest on him. His mouth opened, but no sound came out.
"I heard we're swapping lipstick," Joey continued. "Is that right, cartel guy?"
Aragon cleared his throat, which sounded in need of clearing.
"I would prefer you not refer to me as
cartel guy? But a narco-capitalist megalomaniac is a mouthful. And I figured since we'll be working together, we'd better establish some shorthand."
Evan turned to Aragon, managed to get words to come out of his face hole.
"My associate has an unorthodox sense of humor."
He glared into the monitor. Joey's bunny dog mouth panted affably at him.
"Perhaps you could try a more professional filter if we're going to..."
"Righto."
Joey's hands, which Evan noted with dismay had been transmogrified into furry bear paws, fluttered across the keyboard. And then she was ensconced in a fat filter, chins billowing, eyes rolling in a watermelon head.
"Hang on. Hang on."
Now a giant bobbing mustache sprang to life.
"Better?"
"Is this some kind of fucking joke?"
Special Ed said. "Is this little girl for real?"
Aragon turned crisply to Evan.
"I'm not certain I trust this associate of yours sufficiently to grant her access to my databases."
"Well, that's a shame," Joey said, "since I'm already in."
Her giant fingers splayed and typed, the monitors all around them populating with windows, code, images. Eduardo said,
"How the fuck did she..."
"Duh. Turns out this video chat?
It ain't just a video chat. And you know what else?
I want to be paid in jelly donuts."
She was speaking inexplicably in what seemed to be a southern accent.
"Your accent is terrible," Evan told Fat Joey. "Are you supposed to be southern or French?"
"I'm not French, boy."
"I'd asked you to handle this with maturity."
"You want maturity? Kay? How about some gramouflage?"
Joey clicked over to an old age filter. She looked like the offspring of Gollum and old Picasso.
"I'm sending through the location of the body that was mistaken for your daughter's," ancient Joey said through wrinkled lips.
"And the files. I've charted out various travel route trajectories along which she might have lost her necklace. They're on your left monitor."
"No, your other left.
I see you have, like, tons of intel on the Leonis on your end, but I'll also send through everything I've compiled here. And Raul Montesco, or as he likes to be called, El Moreno."
She laid on the accent, Aragon stiffening at the mere mention of the name. Plus his son Raimundo, his sicarios, lieutenants, accountants, all that. Their main HQ, a super-secret Bond villain lair rumored to be somewhere outside Guaridon's squares with the route trajectories. But that's dead center of their territory. There's no getting at it. As far as I can tell, if someone sneezes near Guaridon, the Leones hear about it. Aragon was ashen. You think that's where she is? In Guaridon? Dunno, Joey said. But I'm guessing even the Nowhere Man isn't dumb enough to walk through there knocking on doors and asking questions. No, Aragon said. There is Guaridon, and then there is the rest of the world. Which is why I've traced a bunch of secondary compounds, conveniently located outside of